So I'm going to present about Sky130 and Tiny Tapeout, first presenting what Sky130 actually is, and then some tooling, and then explain what Tiny Tapeout is and how it's related. Sky130, it's an IC manufacturing process from SkyWater Technology. As the 130 refers to the minimal feature size you can make on it, which is obviously 150 nanometers. I guess 130 sounded better, so they used that. It's originally a process from Cypress that has been spun off some time ago into a separate entity, and now they have other processes. Why is it special? Well, it's kind of the first open source PDK. I said open source in quote because what does it even mean exactly for?
What's a PDK?
Yes, yes, I know. I'm going to come to that word right after. One word at a time. What does it mean to be open source for a PDK, and what even is a PDK? So it's a process development kit, and it's basically all the stuff that you need to know how to manufacture a chip on that process. And so it's what you need to know to design the chips. It is not how to actually make them, right? So there is still a lot of proprietary information. You can design chip for it, but you're not going to be able to make it in your lab, or nobody is going to be able to copy that process because that is still proprietary information from SkyWater. I will explain more in detail what exactly is in that PDK and what is not. It came about from a collaboration. It's been mostly pushed by Google and Tim Ansel, more specifically. It's been a collaboration between the foundry, eFabless, which is like a fabless chip manufacturer, so they're kind of an intermediate between people wanting to make chip and the foundry. There has been other PDK releases since then. GF180, it's from Global Foundries, and it's actually a 190 nanometer process. And that's also been kind of pushed by Google and worked on by Google. IHP, which is a German foundry, also has started releasing a PDK for one of their process, SG13 GE2. I'm not sure if Google was even involved in that at all. I think they might actually have gone, you know, trying to follow the trend or release it by themselves or anything like that. And so that's work in progress. That process, though, is more specialized in the sense that it's really targeted at high-performance RF stuff and things like that. The other process are more like generalist processes for mixed signal and stuff like that. Something that's also very useful for Sky130 and later GF180 is that Google actually sponsored manufacturing runs, which means that you could get some chips taped out for free, which is rather unusual because usually it costs money, lots of it. So some feature of that process, so that you know what kind of stuff you can work on. Internally, it has a core voltage of 1.8 volts. That's why it's sometimes called an hybrid 130, 180 nanometer process, because usually true 130 nanometer process would have a lower core voltage. But it has IOs that can go up to 5 volts if you want to, and internally it can even have higher voltages and things like that. The IO, however, are not 5 volt tolerant if they're powered with 3.3 volts. So if you feed 3.3 volt to the IO voltage, you cannot feed 5 volt to the input. Like, don't make that mistake. If you feed 5 volt in the VIO, that's fine. Then it's going to work fine. But something to not destroy your chip. It has what they call one level of local interconnect, which is basically a different layer of metal. 5 true level of metal to do like your interconnect, like in a PCB. It's like you had a 6-layer PCB because you have like 5 layer of metal, 1 layer of local interconnect. You can do inductors. It has nice things like you can do internal capacitors on it. You can do internal resistors on it. Sonos is basically flash. And yeah, as I said, you can do some higher voltage stuff on it, like 10 volt and 20 volt stuff for analog mixed signal things. So yeah, what is a PDK and what does it mean for it to be open source? So as I said, a PDK itself is mostly information and documentation. There is some data file in there, which is basically documentation in a machine-readable format. And it's how everything you need to make, to create the file that you will be able to submit to the foundry for the foundry to make your chip. As I said, it does not include the details about how the foundry will actually make your chip using those files. That is not included in there, which means that this is not portable at all. Like, every process is different. One 130 nanometer process is not another, and you cannot take one design that you've designed for this manufacturing process and go to another one and ask them to make the chip. That will not work. If you want to port your design from one foundry to another, it's a lot of work. Sometimes complete redesign. Sometimes they have, there's actually some foundries which have like collaborative agreement between them so that their processes are more or less compatible and you can do it with less work, but you still need to requalify and things like that. You can actually find some documents from Lattice, for instance, that that has changed one foundry of the FPGA of the ECP5 to another, and you can actually find some report about the testing and all the steps there to go through. It's anyway. So what you find in there, well, as I said, documentation, like literally paper things, I mean, PDFs and things like that, that describe a variety of things, mostly the various layers and the process stack, design rules, which is basically, you know, like when you make a PCB, like how thin can your trace be, or how close can it be to another, that kind of stuff, except there is a lot more of them, and sometimes really weird things, and then you have, yeah. I will show an example of what's in there. It also explains what kind of devices you can make on them, you know, like transistors and what kind of transistors and how you make them, like how you draw them, what's available. It contains standard cells. Standard cells is basically, you know, when you make a digital chip, especially, you're not reinventing the wheel every time, so you're not going to draw transistors, especially. You're going to use pre-made, or what I call standard cell, which implement the AND gate, a flip-flop, OR gate, and all of these things are already made. They've been drawn by the foundry to be the best they can be, in theory. And they will provide you a set of standard cell for that, and you can feed that to your synthesis tool, and your synthesis tool is going to take your Verilog design, or your VHDL design, or your MyGen design, or whatever, and convert it into a list of those standard cells, and then you just instantiate those standard cells, basically, to create your design. So that's what the process stack looks like for Sky 130. It shows you have like five layers of metal. You have vias between them, and you know, the higher they are, the bigger they get, which means that the bigger the trace have to be, but also the better they conduct power, for instance. So the top layer are mostly used for power distribution, that kind of things. And in the lower layer, you find, you know, like the gates of your NMOS and things like that. And you've got many, many more layers than what's described there. That's like a very high level overview of the device you have. You find design rules, so that's an example screen, and I can actually look at the actual website with here. These are what they call the periphery rules, and you will have, you know, if I look for metal 2, okay, it's going to tell me like the width of a metal 2 needs to be 140 nanometers. It has to be spaced at least 140 nanometers from other traces. But then you've got some weird other rules, is that it cannot be more than 4 micron wide. The density of metal has to be up to 77% of metal. You cannot have more density than that, and the density is going to be checked every 25 micron in a 50 by 50 by micron rule. So you've got literally a ton of those rules, and everything you design has to obey all of those, which means that yeah, it's fun if you try to design something from scratch and drawing it, you know, by hand. You have to keep all of those rules in mind when you design things, basically. To the presentation. Yeah, you've got the list of devices that you can manufacture. So here it says, you know, you can make a 1.8 volt MOSFET and they will give you some characterization data for those, but you can make a 5 volt MOSFET, you can make PFETs, you can make, you know, bipolar transistors if you want, and they will tell you how they are and which layer they will be used and that kind of stuff. You can make polysilicon resistors, and they will explain to you, okay, like you need to draw those layers, they have these characteristics. You will get the characterization data, like the nominal value and the minimum and maximum value, because no two wafers are the same, which means that you're going to get a huge variation. So, for instance, you get like this resistor, it's going to be somewhere between 600 ohm and 1.3 kilo ohm. And that's, you have to design your stuff so that whatever the value ends up being, it has to work. Yeah. So that's the kind of information they provide. And of course, the standard cells. So that's an example of one standard cell. You can see here the drawing. On the top, you get all the PMOS. On the bottom, you get all the NMOS and then all the metal connection between them to achieve. Here, it's apparently a two-input OR that feeds into a four-input NAND. And that's one standard cell. And you have like a bunch of weird optimized combination like that that the synthesis tool is going to try to map to as best as it can. And those standard cells are designed in a special way. You can see you've got a power rail on the top, which is power, and the ground is at the bottom. And they're made so that you can arrange them in a big grid, basically. And you place them in a big grid, like all you, like if you were placing basically 7400 series logic chips in a grid, like you did in the old days. And then the auto router is actually will route it for you. Also, like old auto router did, with, you know, one layer is dedicated for horizontal connection, one layer is dedicated for vertical connection, and that's how it's gonna route the signal for you. Because if you had to route all of that by hand, then it's not gonna happen. So a few tools that you might encounter if you try to decide to work. Most of these are not specific to SKY 130, but they sometimes existed way before. But they have a SKY 130 information, because for most of these, you need to kind of configure them, because the PDK has some machine-readable files, like it has timing data for the standard cells, for instance, telling you, okay, like the delay of propagation of the signal through this standard cell is this, minimum this, maximum this, in at this temperature, at this core voltage, that kind of stuff. These are more like standardized format, but there is a lot of information that doesn't have a standardized way of being expressed, and so that means that for a lot of tools you need to write a lot of configuration files for that specific process, that and that's not provided by the foundry. You have to do it yourself. So OpenLearn 2 is a tool that's used for digital design. It's basically, the goal is Verilog to GDS. GDS being sort of the Gerber, if you're familiar with PCB design, it's basically a file that encapsulates all the layers that you send to the fab, and the fab is going to manufacture whatever is in that in that file for you. And the goal is you take Verilog design or any other HDL, realistically, feed it to that tool, and it produces a GDS that you can get manufactured. I cited especially OpenLearn 2 rather than the original OpenLearn because it's much better. It's written in Python. It's much more customizable. It's much easier to work with. And especially important for me, it's much better if you want to run it without using Docker. Because OpenLearn was somehow, yeah, very integrated with Docker. Like, there was no way to run it natively almost. But in a sense, OpenLearn 2 is mostly a tool sequencer, in the sense that it just calls the right tool in the right order using the right intermediate files, organizing different things to get to a chip design. It has very little, I'm not going to say it has very little actual work done to it, because sequencing everything and keeping everything coherent and dealing with all of that is a lot of work. But the various steps are actually done by some other tools. One of the more important one being OpenRoad, which is going to do a lot of the steps to generate the file. Things like placing the various standard cell, decide where they go, The actual routing between these is going to be handled by the OpenLane static timing analysis, which means checking, okay, at what frequency can I run my design? Like, is it good? Is it bad? Does it meet the timing requirements? Clock distribution, ensuring that the clock arrives to all your flip-flops at the same time, because signals take time to propagate, and for clocks, it's more important that they arrive at least at a known time. It has something really... So the format it uses are DEF and LEF, which are kind of a standard way of exchanging information. It's not specific to OpenRoute. It's more like an industry standard thing. So like commercial tools also support them. And it's for cell-based design. It basically expresses the database of what standard cell you instantiate and how they are connected, where they're placed, how the routing is, and that kind of stuff. And most important thing is that all of that information, you actually have an API to access it, and that API has Python bindings. That makes it really easy if you want to do some custom things, because let's say if you have like a very regular structure that you know how to route and you want to just route that, for instance, you can use the API to place it manually and route it manually, and then let the auto router do all the other stuff, for instance. And so it's pretty nice. That was for digital design, but at least for me, the interesting part is more mixed signal design, because, I mean, digital design, you can do it on FPGA most of the time. So what's interesting is do some a bit of analog and mixing the two, and for that you need some schematic capture. The one that's kind of recommended at the moment is Xchem. It's not been written at all for Sky130 or anything. It was pre-existing, but the author has written a Sky130 integration, which is just creating all the devices and things like that, and making sure everything works nicely. Compared to other schematic capture tool like KiCad, it has some nice things for ASIC design, like parameterized device, you know, like specifying the size of your MOSFET and things like that. That fit better, and at the output it can produce a spiciness list, which is good for simulation, but also for checking that your circuit that you've implemented on chip actually matches your design. We'll see that later, because once you've designed your circuit in a schematic capture tool, the next thing is laying it out, which is actually drawing the devices and connecting them and stuff like that. And for that, you can actually use there's two tools. This one is called Magic, Magic VLSI. So it's a layout tool, which honestly, it's kind of like paint. You literally paint every layer, like metal layer, diffusion layer, everything. You need to paint it manually, square by square. It has some helpers, you know, to draw wires and stuff like that. But yeah, mostly it's kind of a paint program. Some nice things that it has is live DRC. So it will actually check dynamically while you draw the various DRC rules that you need to obey and tell you if you're violating any of them, which is very convenient, because keeping them all in your head is hard to track. P cells are called parameterized cells, so if you don't want to draw a MOSFET by yourself, there's a little helper. You tell him, okay, I want to draw that type of device with those dimensions. It will draw it for you, and then you can move it around and things like that. Derived layer is kind of a nice feature too, is that usually when you want to draw a MOSFET or any kind of devices, you need to draw in several different layers, and those layers need to be consistent with each other. So, you know, let's say that you want to connect from the lowest metal layer to the diffusion and stuff like that. It turns out that you need to also draw in NPC, which is like nitride polycut, which is you need to cut into some levels of titanium nitride or something. And all of these need to be consistent with each other, and Magic will take care of that for you. You just draw a contact and it will generate some of the derived layers automatically. And you don't have to care about that, which makes drawing devices and things like that a lot easier. It is entirely scriptable in Tkl. A fun anecdote is that actually Tkl was invented for Magic. Like the Tkl author and the Magic author are the same, and he actually wrote Tkl because he was looking for a language to automate EDA tooling, and none of them was good enough, and so he actually invented Tkl, and so that's why Tkl exists, and so obviously it's well integrated with Magic, but that also gives you that like, this tool is not modern or recent by any means. That predates Sky 130 by a long while. Something that it will do also is that from a drawing of devices and from those different layers, it will do a spice extraction. So it will analyze those layers and see, okay, yeah, like at this spot, I have a diffusion and a poly that goes over it. That's a MOSFET. So it's going to extract a MOSFET. It will analyze the dimension, fill it in, and create an actual spice netlist that describes the transistors and the various devices that are on your circuit. Based on what you've drawn. It will also extract parasitics. So it will see that, okay, I have this layer of metal over that layer of metal that's gonna create a capacitance of this and this value. This metal trace has this resistance because, you know, no metal is perfect. And it will create a spice nest list with all of that, which will allow to compare it with the theoretical netlist that you've drawn in your schematic capture to make sure that what you've drawn actually matches what you wanted to draw. K-Layout is a more recent layout program written for KDE. It was originally mostly a viewer tool, but now it has some editing capabilities. It has DLC, but it doesn't have live DLC, so you need to run it every time you want to check it. It has definitely a nicer UI, and to browse things, it's much nicer, but it definitely lacks some of the quality of life things from Magic when you try to design. I mean, at least in my opinion, but I've not used it much, so I can't really comment. It doesn't have any derived layers, so you need to draw every layer manually. And it has a Ruby and Python API. There are tons of other tools that you will encounter. I've cited two here. One is ngSpice, obviously, like the spice simulator. You want to simulate all your circuits. The other is NetGen, very important. That's what's called LVS, layout versus schematic. And it basically compares the layout extracted by Magic with the one from XCAM, the one that you actually implemented versus the one you wanted. And it will resolve things like it will know that, okay, this was a parasitic resistor, it should match. It will also see that if you have two different MOSFETs, but they're connected, like all the terminals are connected, it's actually not two MOSFETs, it's actually one bigger MOSFET, that kind of stuff. So it has some smarts integrated. So now that you have all the information and all the tooling to design your chip, how do you get it made? Well, Google shuttles. I mean, Google sponsors some shuttles. That's great. Bad news is it's over. They did 8 runs in Sky 130, and they haven't formally said that there's not going to be another, but there hasn't been another for 2 years, so like, I think. So it's unlikely that that's going to happen. EFabless has its own kind of cheap manufacturing program where you can get 100 chips made and packaged. They give you like QFN chips and not just the bare die. You get an area of 10 square millimeter and you pay only 10,000 euro, which is honestly not bad, $10,000, but yeah. Which is a pretty good deal, but again, not really kind of obese friendly. Obviously, if you're, they have other option if you want more than 100 chips, like if you want to actually make some product run and stuff like that, but those are not, the price are not available for those. You could also contact SkyWater directly. I haven't tried, but as far as I've heard, it's not trivial because EFabless does do a little bit of data massaging between what you send them and what they send SkyWater. So I'm not sure how trivial that would be. And also there is like no pricing available whatsoever. I have no idea how much that would cost or what the quantity involved would be. When does my time slot end? Okay, thank you. So the other option is Tiny Tapeout. So Tiny Tapeout is a project that's been started by Matt Venn and Rishak Shahid. And the general idea is that we get one of those cheap Ignite slot of 10 square millimeter a year when we split it between many designs and we just share access to the I/O. The advantage is that that allows to reduce the cost. The current billing structure is that you pay $50 for one of those small area that has been divided, but that just gets you a slot on the chip. If you want to actually receive one of the chip, you have to pay. If you're in the first 100 people, so not companies, you pay only $100. If you want more chips, or if you're not among the first 100, you have to pay $250. But that allows, for instance, like an educational program or stuff like that, you know, if they have 30 students, they can buy 30 tiles but buy only two chips, for instance, and cut the things like that. Every chip that you get has all the design from everybody, because only the I/O are mixed, so like we don't slice the dice or anything like that. So you get access to whatever people have put on there, and you can play with it or just look at it to see and learn from it. That's how the first three tiny tape out looked, more or less. It was scan chain based, so think like JTAG, where you just clock serially everything one after the other. Obviously, that's very, very slow I/O update rate, because even if you clock your scan chain at, let's say, 100 megahertz, you have, I think here there was like 250 projects in the chain. Every project has 8 I/O, so you need like, I don't know, 8,000 clock cycles for every I/O refresh cycle. So the I/O update rate was really limited to a few kilohertz. In those particular one, you could either control them externally, so you literally got access to the actual scan chain and the clock and the data input and output from the serial scan chain. That was kind of the fail-safe option, like in case everything else failed, the chip didn't arrival, we can still use it. But the more convenient way to use it, there was an internal controller that would handle all the scanning for you and would just map the eight I/O from one project to 8 pins for input and 8 pins for output from the selected project. We did hit some problem that limited the speed even more, is that we couldn't run the scan chain at the speed we wanted, because it turns out that rising edge and falling edge don't propagate at the same speed. And when you have a scan chain that's 8,000 buffer long, your clock pulse suddenly shrinks at every buffer. And at some point, there's no clock pulse left. Lesson learned. In the newer runs, from TT04 to the TT06, which is the one that just shipped a few weeks ago, the architecture is completely different. It's basically MUX-based. We offer the user 10 inputs, 8 outputs, and 8 bidirectional signals. The 10 inputs, we've technically split them between general purpose and clock and reset, but in fact, there is absolutely no difference between them, except for the name. The inputs are handled by distribution tree, so they're basically buffered at each layer and progressively distributed. And just before the user project, there is an AND gate that put it to zero if the project is not the active project. For the outputs, it's just basically a tree of MUX and some tri-state buffer for like shared bus line, both horizontally and vertically. You can actually see here we have like a layer of MUX that's horizontal first, and then that intersects with the vertical spine that's handled by tri-state buffer, and then this all gets to the center. Where this takes everything and sends it to the actual I/O pads, which are all the stuff on the side. What are the current features that we support? Well, the area is divided into 512 tiles, so that's about 160 micron to 110 micron. It's not big, but for a lot of test projects and stuff like that, it's actually not that small either. If you want more, you can actually combine them. Design can be up to 2 tile high and 8 tile wide. We're looking into allowing up to 4 tile high, for bigger design, but to give you a rough idea, one of the designs that was taped into the maximum area, 8x2, was Linux capable RISC-V, so you can put some serious digital design if you want to play with it. And for analog, it's pretty big too. We allow custom GDS now. Previously, we only allowed like a Verilog, and then it would be synthesized by us, basically. But now, because we literally cut off power to projects that are not active, we can allow people to upload arbitrary design because there is much less risk for us. You know, previously, if we feed power to everybody and in your design you short power to ground, you've just killed the entire chip for everybody. Here, because we literally don't send power or anything to your chip, to your tile rather, until your project is selected, we can allow more custom stuff. We have basic support for analog chip, analog lines, because before it was only digital. Now we actually have some analog pins. Currently limited to 1.8 volts, 3.3 volt support is coming. We just need to bring 3.3 volt to the actual tiles and have some analog switch that are 3.3 volt tolerant. Something that makes or starting all of that easier for beginners or people that don't want to invest a lot of time is that if you want to test a purely digital design, you can actually just use the GitHub action. So you just push to a special template in the, you clone a special template on GitHub to start your project. And there is some GitHub action setup that will actually install and run all the tools for you in the GitHub action and go from your Verilog to GDS and passes all the pre-checks so you don't have to install anything locally other than Git. Now, the bad news is that that does not speed up manufacturing time, and between the moment you submit and the moment you get your chip back, it's about 8 months. So we've actually taped out Tiny Tapeout 4, 5, and 6. We did get TT04 back. We haven't heard from TT05 or TT06, obviously, which means we have not even any idea if they work. But the previous one worked, so we're fairly confident that we didn't screw up too badly. And there is a bunch of leak and resources if you're interested. That's it.
Questions? The one on the slide said tap out on the top, but it's tape out, right? That one.
Yes, it's tape out. Yes, I forgot an E. Well done. Yeah.
What kind of designs do the people make? So what do we have in all those many projects?
I mean, it varies greatly. Like, some people are literally just taped out an AND gate between, you know, just drawing some basic logic or some UART. In the more complex digital design, you find a bunch of people either taping out custom RISC-V and things like that, or custom CPU, like the thing that they completely made up. In the analog, TT06 was the first one that allowed analog, and so here we have more, you know, interesting design like test op amp and stuff like that. But there is also like the an ADC that's taped out, that's been included, that's from the Nordic Semiconductor principal IC designer at Nordic Semi that taped out something on there. So you've got a wide variety of you know, people with experience and people just starting from, yeah.
Yeah, I had a similar question. What did you submit?
Honestly, at the moment, not much, because I've been too busy working on the infrastructure for Tiny Tapeout that I didn't have the time to tape out much. The only thing I have on the TT06 is mostly a test structure that's designed to test a power delivery network. And so it's basically a dummy load on the chip so that we can induce any current between, you know, a few hundred microamp to a few milliamps and monitor with Kelvin connection what voltage actually gets there so that we can test it. I'm hoping to test a ROM compiler in TT07. That's the upcoming one.
I'm trying to understand like the workflow to arrive to the PDK file. Like I saw some very log code and then those schematics in those.
So basically it depends a lot if you want to do a digital design or an analog design. If you want to do a digital design, you will mostly use something like OpenLane 2, which will basically go through a flow similar to what you would find on a FPGA. It goes through synthesis and then placement and routing, except that using instead of using FPGA cells, it will use the standard cell library from the vendor. If you want to do an analog design, then it's much more involved because you have to go through XCAM, where you basically do your design, designing it like this, like transistor by transistor, basically. And testing it in simulation with the theoretical schematic, and then you have to, like you would lay out a PCB, you have to lay out the device and place them and connect them, evaluate, okay, like this device needs to be matched to that one and that kind of stuff, and drawing all of that manually, and then extracting that with the parasitics, various capacitance and stuff that you've created accidentally, basically, and check that your design still works and meets its specification when extracted that way.
Right. And is there too many unexpected behavior, like you send to tiny tape out and then it ends up that the chip doesn't do what you specified and it's complete garbage? Like,
I mean, so far we've been pretty lucky, but it's there's definitely things that you can overlook. It's very easy to overlook some things and get like the very first I had a design on the very first Google sponsored manufacturing run, which was USB controller and stuff like that, but it turns out there was a bug in the in some of the tooling actually provided by IFA. There was a bug both in the tooling and in some of the blocks provided by the by IFABless. That turned out that this chip was mostly dead in the water, and like you couldn't really do anything useful with it. So yeah, it's very easy to overlook something. That's why for Tiny Tape Out, we're trying to make the infrastructure, like all the thing that muxes the project and stuff like that, as simple as we can, with as little smarts in it, basically, because that the least we do, the least can fail, basically.
Thank you.
What I'm wondering is how reliable is it? I mean, is it possible that I can tape out a chip that is from the architecture completely right? Everything is correct, but the manufacturing has some problem.
I mean, it's not impossible because we, you know, chip can have defects and stuff like that. But 130 nanometers is not by any means pushing the limits of technology of today, right? Which means that the yield of the fab actually making the device properly is very, very high. So although it is possible, it's very unlikely that if you designed everything and you simulated everything and you didn't overlook anything, it's very unlikely that the manufacturing process will fail in some way.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Again.